Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Why was the Boston Tea Party such a powerful symbol of the American desire for liberty and self-rule, and how did it serve to unite the 13 colonies in their rebellion against the British? The events of December 16, 1773 are legendary in American history, but King George's tax on imported tea was hardly the first such assessment to outrage colonial settlers. Journalist and historian Harlow Giles Unger shares the stories of early American patriots and British-sanctioned colonial governors and how their actions touched off a full-scale revolution in his new book, American Tempest, How the Boston Tea Party Sparked a Revolution. Harlow, welcome to Think.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to be here.
There had been multiple taxes enacted by the British government on the colonists before the tea tax, and in most cases, the British ultimately relented. Can you talk about the Stamp Act and some other things that had taken place before the tea tax?
Yes, indeed. The first tax that the British imposed on Americans was the stamp tax in 1764. The Americans were furious at the stamp tax, especially in Boston. They saw it as a direct tax. Americans, not only in Boston, but across the country, had come to this continent and built businesses, carved farms out of the wilderness on their own without any help from the government. And therefore, they felt there was no need to share any of their wealth with the government. So they were outraged by the stamp tax. Actually, the stamp tax had very little effect on the average citizen. It really affected three powerful special interest groups, merchants, publishers, and lawyers. Merchants had to put a stamp on every one of their documents, their purchase orders, their bills of sale. Publishers had to put a stamp on every newspaper and magazine they printed. And lawyers had to put a stamp on every document they issued, deeds, wills, and so forth. So they were outraged by this. And Sam Adams, who was the son of the famed brewer, was out of work and saw a means of making some money out of this. And he organized unemployed waterfront workers into a mob to protest the stamp tax. And they went around attacking stamp commissioners, burning their homes, and causing riots all over the Boston waterfront. And he encouraged similar radical leaders in other port cities along the coast to do the same. Well, this soon interfered with British trade so much that British merchants in England lobbied Parliament to repeal that tax. The tax, as I say, really had very little effect on the average citizen.
Including those waterfront workers.
Including those waterfront workers. But these special interest groups were very, very powerful. And so they were able to get this repealed. It outraged Britain after the repeal because we had just fought a war, the Seven Years' War. In America, it was called the French and Indian War. And the British had sent an army over here to protect American colonists. And the British government and the British people wondered why American colonists were not paying any taxes to help support that army, which was here to protect them. Actually, British farmers rioted in protest against their own high taxes and against the refusal of Americans to pay any taxes to support an army that was here to protect them.
So it wasn't simply the British government deciding, hey, here's a great source of revenue. There was great political pressure on them at the time.
Oh, absolutely. The government was broke. They had spent all this money on a costly war, and they saw no reason that American colonists should not contribute to the cost of that war. It was similar. American colonists then, the so-called Tea Partiers then, were pretty much like a lot of Tea Partiers today. They want the government to conduct an expensive war, but they don't want to pay any taxes or they don't want any tax hikes to pay for that war.
What rights and responsibilities did colonial residents have to the motherland?
What rights?
Well, what rights? I mean, we know they didn't have direct representation, and beyond the taxes, were there any particular obligations that people had?
Well, this was a cloak of constitutionality that the tax protesters tried to waive. There was no taxation without representation, and it's true that Americans were not represented in the British Parliament, but that really is nonsense. The fact is that only one in nine voters in England was represented in Parliament. Hmm. So very few British people or colonists, I mean, we were all British subjects, very few British subjects anywhere in England or out had any representation in Parliament. But that did not... That did not offset the fact that Britain was fighting a war for its survival, and Parliament felt every British subject was duty-bound to pay taxes to pay for that war, fair or unfair, with or without representation in Parliament. The British people here and in England had a responsibility to pay for the cost of that war.
Did the British government, once this rallying cry of no taxation without representation, did they pay attention to that and ever consider throwing a bone in the form of some sort of representation to the colonists, or did they think this was about money alone?
It was about money alone, because the colonists, after all, were making a fortune out of the war. These merchants who refused to pay taxes, they were making a fortune shipping. They owned the ships that brought the arms to the British forces in America. They supplied the foodstuffs and all the war material that came from this continent. So they made a fortune out of the war. And, to make matters worse, they smuggled arms to the enemy. After the British defeated the French forces here in America, as British troops combed through the ruins of various French fortifications, they learned that most of the French arms had been shipped in by the same merchants in Boston who were shipping arms to the British Army. So they were shipping arms to the enemy as well as their own army, and they refused to pay taxes.
So another assessment that just made the colonists furious was this duty on molasses, which, among other things, is very helpful in making rum.
Absolutely. This whole thing about the first of all, there was no British constitution, and they talked about British constitutional rights. There is no such thing as a British constitution. When the British refer to their constitution, and this is true today as it was then, they're referring to a vague accumulation of common law, of court decisions, and of actual laws that have been passed. But there's no document called the British Constitution that is comparable to our Constitution.
So when we go back, so that you have in the same year, you have the tax on molasses, and then there is the tea tax. First of all, how much was the tax on tea?
The tea tax amounted to nothing, and tea was totally unimportant. The tea tax was part of a group of taxes that the Chancellor of the Exchequer, that was the equivalent of our Secretary of Treasury, that he convinced Parliament to pass. After they repealed the Stamp Act, Britain was still broke and still needed money to pay for its army. So Charles Townsend, the British Secretary of Treasury, decided, okay, they're complaining about direct taxation, so we won't tax the Americans directly. We'll tax the goods that we ship to America. We'll put an import duty on the goods that go to America. Most of the goods that were taxed were luxury products that again, had no effect on the average subject in the Americas. 95% of the people lived on farms. They made their own clothes. They made their own tools. They really didn't buy many imported goods. The people who bought imported goods were largely the wealthy, who loved their British and European furniture and furnishings, their wines, their gourmet foodstuffs. So again, the Townsend import duties affected the very wealthy for the most part. and it affected products such as glass, china, and products like that, and tea. Well, tea was terribly unimportant. Most Americans drank rum or ale. Only wealthy women served tea as a social beverage in their homes. And the tax on that tea for each person, again, was insignificant. It was one tenth of one penny for a 9-penny cup of tea. In other words, it was 1/100 of 1%. It was nothing. But again, the merchants complained. The Parliament repealed the Townsend duties, except for one duty, the least significant one, the one on tea, which they retained as a symbol of parliamentary authority to tax all British subjects anywhere in the world, regardless of their consent. So, again, the merchants were outraged because it did cut somewhat into their profits on shipments of tea. And again, they got the unemployed waterfront workers under Sam Adams to stage riots and protest the tea tax.
Let's talk a little bit more about Sam Adams. He was sort of ran the family brewery into the ground. His kids were raised in abject poverty, but he had a real gift for propaganda. Maybe we should say communication. What he believed, he was able to convince other people.
He was a rabble rouser. Basically, he was a ne'er do well. He went to Harvard. Was the son of Sam Adams Sr., who had founded and ran America's most successful brewery. When the father died, young Sam Adams, who hadn't done a day's work after graduating from Harvard, he was truly a ne'er-do-well. He had taken a few jobs and lost them, and really spent his time writing a lot of propaganda and trying to get published unsuccessfully. So when he inherited the brewery, within a short time he ran that in the ground. He was sloppy at home, didn't care much for doing anything. His wife died, leaving him with two children, and this champion of liberty bought himself a slave to take care of his children. And as you said, they grew up eventually in abject poverty. And while he roamed the waterfront, and oddly enough, roamed all the taverns along the waterfront, oddly enough, he did not drink. He was not a drinker. But he haunted the waterfront and gradually organized these unemployed workers into a powerful street mob that eventually gave him enormous political power.
I thought it was interesting that Sam Adams spent part of his career working as a tax collector. Not a very good one, but he was a tax collector.
Well, after he ran the family brewery in the ground, he had no source of income. And friends of his father, political friends of his father, who were involved in the local government, gave him a sinecure as a tax collector, which required no work on his part, just to collect the taxes and count the money, obviously, and hand it over to the city government. Within months, shortages began to appear in his collections, and by the time they did an audit, it was found that he was 8,000 pounds, British pounds, which were worth a lot of money in those days. He was 8,000 pounds short. They didn't know at first whether he simply hadn't collected the money or whether he had embezzled the funds, and later on he was convicted of embezzlement.
Journalist
That's the kind of guy Sam Adams was.
Journalist and historian Harlow Giles Unger is my guest. His new book is called American Tempest, How the Boston Tea Party Sparked a Revolution. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's summer youth programs. Camps in computers, writing, art, math, science, and Legos held at SMU in Plano and on the main campus in Dallas. You can learn more at smu.edu/summeryouth.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is journalist and historian Harlow Giles Unger. His new book is called American Tempest, How the Boston Tea Party Sparked a Revolution. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can do it by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. Harlow, obviously we'll talk more in a few minutes about the really well-known names of early American patriotism. But another person that you write about that is not a household word today is this attorney James Otis Jr., whose motivations were as much personal as anything else in fighting against the British government. Can you tell us a little bit about him?
Yes. Sam, he was a close friend of Sam Adams. And he had a grudge against the British government. His father had been the logical choice for Supreme Court justice, but the royal governor rejected the appointment at the last minute because the father was had he taken his seat as a judge, he would have then overseen a case in which his son was the primary attorney. This was a clear conflict of interest. The father refused to recuse himself from the case, and the son refused to withdraw. So the Chief Justice had no choice but to kill the nomination of the father as Chief Justice. And Sam Otis Jr., who was not quite sane most of the time, certainly was what we call neurotic at this point, absolutely blew his top and told everyone who would listen, "I shall set the province in flame, even if I die in the attempt." And from that point on, he was truly unbalanced was so anti-British, he stomped into a tavern frequented by British officers and provoked a fight. One of the officers clubbed him over the head with the broadside of a sword, and although Otis recovered from the physical wound, he never seemed to recover his sanity, and at times he would stick his head out and his arms out the window of his house and fire at imaginary British enemies in the park. At one time, he stomped into the assembly, the state assembly, and challenged the prime minister, pulled out his sword, challenged the prime minister in London to come to Boston and fight a duel. Well, his friends tied him down to a chair and carried him to the insane asylum. So he and Sam Adams, those are the two heroes, so-called heroes of the Tea Party movement, and the one was unbalanced, and the one was truly a ne'er-do-well who was out for personal power.
So obviously, as this movement gained strength, there needed to be money. Talk about how that influenced the relationship between John Hancock and Sam Adams.
John Hancock was arguably the wealthiest merchant banker, and that's what they were called in those days because there was no hard currency in the colonies. Most transactions were done by barter, so that large merchants, the House of Hancock was the largest merchant house in Boston. They would, for example, lend or give tools to a farmer in exchange for the farmer pledging his next crop. So in a sense, these merchants were also bankers. They were lending to their clients. And when the duties were passed, the Townsend duties that we spoke about earlier, when these were enacted, merchants like Hancock simply evaded them and started smuggling. So the original Tea Party movement was a movement among merchants to smuggle goods in from other countries and from England without paying any duties. These were smugglers. These were not patriots, and they did it for greed. And when the government objected, they paid Sam Adams to pay, in turn, these unemployed waterfront workers to stage protests. As the Massachusetts royal governor at that time, Thomas Hutchinson, whose ancestors dated back to the early 1700s. One of his ancestors was a great religious leader, Anne Hutchinson. And Hutchinson was outraged at the tactics of the merchants in organizing these mobs. And he said, there is nothing so easy as to persuade people that they are badly governed.
So, in other words, he was recognizing the fact that they would be irritated almost regardless of what the British government did.
Oh, absolutely. Hutchinson said that you can take the happiest, most comfortable people, and I'm quoting Hutchinson, you can take the happiest and most comfortable people and use malicious rhetorical skills to arouse popular discontent with their government, with their rulers, and with everything around them, even themselves.
So Harlow, do you think that the colonists, the patriots, had no legitimate complaints against the British government?
Not at that time. Not at that time. What happened in the wake of the rioting, and incidentally, Washington and other respected leaders, the most respected leaders across the nation, condemned the people of Boston, both the British government and most Americans. Felt that these Bostonians were ungovernable because of the constant rioting of these waterfront thugs instigated by the Boston merchants out of greed. So at that time, there was no reason for them to complain. The taxes were minimal. They weren't as high as British people in Britain were paying. And this army, their army, was over here to protect them against French and Indian attacks.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. My guest is Harlow Giles Unger, author of American Tempest, How the Boston Tea Party Sparked a Revolution. Let's go on the phones now to Leslie in Southlake. Hi, Leslie.
Hi there. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
Professor Unger, I was wondering if you could expound on the relationship and the obvious, well, some of them obvious differences between John Adams and his cousin.
Well, they really didn't know each other as children. They had no relationship as children. They got to know each other later on because they both served. They were leaders in Boston. John Adams was the younger of the two and became a prominent attorney. His first important case was in defense of the British officers and troops involved in the Boston Massacre. That trial in which John Adams was not a Tory. He defended and nonetheless defended the British troops, and they were found guilty by a jury of local farmers. The farmers were not Tories either. They were local, and they found those officers innocent of murder, although they did convict two of the six soldiers of involuntary manslaughter. They were the ones that fired the guns. That was nothing more than a misdemeanor. And what that trial brought out was Sam Adams's involvement in inciting the mob to riot, and which, of course, the officer had ordered his men to fire at this mob as they approached the officers. It was a threatening mob. And after the trial, the Boston citizens said enough of this violence, and they voted Sam Adams out of office and went back to work. The British troops withdrew from Boston, and everybody would have lived happily ever after, except that a small group of parliamentarians convinced the majority of Parliament. They repealed all of the Townshend duties, but they insisted on keeping the least important duty, the one on tea, as a symbol of Parliament's authority to tax British subjects anywhere in the world, with or without the consent of those subjects. And that triggered more smuggling by the largest importers of tea, which included John Hancock's company. And the smuggling led to tighter enforcement by the British customs authorities. When they seized a ship belonging to Hancock, Hancock opened his cash drawer to Sam Adams again to start the riots all over again. And then the British reacted. Unfortunately, they reacted harshly, swiftly, and too forcefully. They sent in troops again into Boston. This was the second time they sent troops in. And this time they passed a quartering act, which allowed the troops to enter into any private house to live there while they were in Boston. And this meant quartering troops in Loyalist houses as well as rebel houses. And soon the entire citizenry of Boston was up in arms and outraged by the British, the activities of the British troops. The British High Command reacted too harshly, too violently, and that's what eventually triggered the revolution.
I'm curious about this, Harlow. There were demonstrations against the tea tax in several other cities in the colonies, in Charleston and New York and Philadelphia. Why do we remember only Boston?
Well, Sam Adams, again, was responsible for this. He set up committees of correspondence in all of these cities. Remember, there was no way of communicating. And he had contacted radical leaders in other cities. After the troops came back into Boston, he organized leaders in other port cities to do the same thing as the people in Boston had done. So there were tea parties up and down the coast and a second tea party in Boston. And when the troops came into Boston, occupied the city, these other leaders were outraged and eventually tried to come to the aid of Bostonians. When finally the troops started marching towards Concord to try to get the capture the arsenal of the local militia, farmers came out of their houses with muskets and started firing on the British troops. And of course, this culminated with the Battle of Lexington and the defeat of the British troops up there, and that encouraged leaders in every area of the country to join the revolution.
What do we know about who actually dressed up in costume on that night in December 1773 and boarded that ship?
Well, the interesting thing is that some of these, there were about 6 to 7 dozen men. We don't know exactly how many there were, but about that number, and many of them disguised themselves as Indians. Now, these were men who would kill Indians on sight, but nonetheless considered Indians a symbol of freedom. Hmm. Although they were unwilling to give the Indians the same freedoms they demanded, but there were about 6 to 7 dozen of them, and they pledged to keep each other's names secret. So we didn't find out their names for quite a few decades until after the Boston Tea Party, when people started looking at each other's diaries or their father's diary, and little by little we put together a list of the participants, and the complete list is in my new book, American Tempest. So if you get a copy of American Tempest, you can get the list of the actual participants in the Boston Tea Party. It'll surprise a lot of people.
It'll surprise people in part because there aren't very many famous names on there.
Well, there are several of them, and I'm sure a lot of readers will be surprised by the names of those who did participate. The real leaders seldom participate in the dirty fighting of any revolution. In France, Robespierre never lifted a gun. Hmm. And in our revolution, Sam Adams never lifted a gun.
How did the relationship between Adams and Hancock start to change as the revolution really took hold?
Well, the problem with revolutionaries like Sam Adams and Robespierre and these madmen who lead the revolution, their instincts are not to are never to build. They don't know how to build, how to create a new government. They know how to tear down, they know how to destroy, and they know how to kill. But they don't have the instincts for rebuilding. So after the revolution actually began, and Sam Adams actually participated in the First Continental Congress, but he said little there. He was pushed aside by the other members of the Congress and never had any real impact on the fighting of the revolution, the actual war with Britain, or the years afterwards in the rebuilding of our nation, the creation of a constitutional government, and the rebuilding of Massachusetts. He was really pushed aside. Hancock, on the other hand, had been a very successful businessman. The House of Hancock was the largest merchant banking institution in the country. So he was actually elected president of the Continental Congress, and in a sense, he was the first president of the United States, although they were then called the United Colonies. And he was very, very successful in Congress had no powers to tax, yet he was successful in organizing loans from France and Holland and getting the funds to underwrite the costs of our revolution.
My guest is journalist and historian Harlow Giles Unger. His new book is called American Tempest, How the Boston Tea Party Sparked a Revolution. Join the conversation by calling us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's summer youth programs. Camps in computers, writing, art, math, science, and Legos held at SMU in Plano and on the main campus in Dallas. You can learn more at smu.edu/summeryouth.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is journalist and historian Harlow Giles Unger. His new book is called American Tempest, How the Boston Tea Party Sparked a Revolution. Join the conversation by calling us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Let's go to the phones now. This time we'll speak with Thomas in Dallas. Hi, Thomas.
Hi. Yeah, I understand that the Green Mountain Boys and the revolution arguably started, you know, about 11 years before the Boston Tea Party with a very populist movement. And you might say that Sam Adams was part of that, and but this account would say the aristocracy in here in America sort of co-opted that movement. You know, and they didn't trust them, and when it came time to rule and once they had power. I'm sorry, I can't remember the patriot we associated with the Green Mountain Boys, but wondered what you thought of that.
What do you think, Harlow?
Well, they had nothing to do with the Boston Tea Party or the movement in Boston. These were all independent colonies. The colonies, and after independence, they became independent states, truly independent countries. They had very, very little contact with each other. Sam Adams had nothing to do with the Green Mountain Boys. Green Mountain Boys really were seeking independence for their little area. Excuse me, of southern Vermont. That had nothing to do with the Boston Tea Party or the Tea Party movement at that time.
Obviously, for the history of the country moving forward from that time, we ought to be grateful that cooler heads, somewhat cooler heads, ultimately prevailed. But I think the ultimate irony here is that for a movement that started with this fury over taxation. In fact, the fledgling United States would go on to tax the former colonists far more than the British government ever had.
Well, this was one of the great ironies that had they not rejected this tiny little tea tax, they never would have become an independent. We never would have had the revolution, and we wouldn't have become an independent country. But instead of paying the little tea tax, when Massachusetts became independent, now suddenly the Massachusetts government not only had to pay for taxes on tea, they had to pay the cost of defense, the cost of postal services, the cost of all of the operations of government, which the British government had hitherto paid virtually free of charge. Now suddenly, instead of a little tiny tax on tea, they had to pay huge taxes for defense, for all these other costs of government. And ironically, 3 years after independence, the farmers in Massachusetts staged a statewide revolution, marched on the Capitol. Same thing in New Hampshire. They marched on the state capitol. In Virginia and Maryland, they burned down courthouses because the courts collected taxes. So there was a new, huge revolution that threatened the nation with anarchy over state taxes. Why Washington and other major leaders called for a constitutional convention, for a convention to write a constitution for a new, powerful central government that could enforce tax laws and enforce all laws. And that's why Patrick Henry, and I wrote a book last fall called Lion of Liberty on Patrick Henry. That's why Patrick Henry called for almost a new revolution to block or turn down the Constitution. He felt the Constitution created a new federal government with all of the powers of the British government that we had spent 7 years trying to overthrow. That the president would have the same powers as the king, and the new Congress would have the same powers as Parliament had to tax Americans without their consent.
And, of course, the first thing that new federal government ultimately would tax was whiskey. Is that right?
That was the first federal tax. Mm-hmm. And, again, as Henry complained, this was passed without the consent of state legislatures, just as Parliament had imposed the Stamp Act and the Townsend Act without the consent of, at that time, colonial legislatures. And what did Washington do? He did exactly what Patrick Henry predicted the president would do. He sent troops, American troops, to put down tax protesters in western Pennsylvania. It's what we call the Whiskey Rebellion.
Mm-hmm.
So Washington did to the western Pennsylvania protesters exactly what the British Parliament had done to tax protesters in Boston.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We'll go back to the phones now, this time speak with Mike in Fort Worth. Hi, Mike.
Hi. I just have a quick question. Does Mr. Unger see a parallel between the causes of the American Revolution and future American military engagements like the Civil War and events like that? And I'll take my answer off the air. Thanks.
Thanks for your call.
To a certain degree, this the Civil War, civil rights protests of the 20th century, the protests against the Vietnam War, all these citizen protests are essentially against federal government, extension of federal government powers to a point that really is in violation of the Constitution. And most of these violations are exactly what Patrick Henry predicted would happen if we ratified the Constitution as written, that the president would have powers to take us to war without the consent of the people, as they have done. Congress, although the Constitution says Congress shall declare war, Congress has only declared war five times in our history, all the other wars we've engaged in, the Mexican War, Vietnam War, the wars in Afghanistan, Iraq, have been the president sent the army out to fight without the consent of Congress. And Congress has passed hundreds of laws and taxes, really, without the consent of the American people. The extent of government intrusion into our daily lives is just endless. The government regulations control things in our bathrooms, our bedrooms, our living rooms, our gardens. They control the air we breathe, the water we drink. The government is everywhere, and this was not what the Constitution had, mandated by the Constitution. So the Tea Party movement today, to a certain degree, is similar to the Tea Party movement in colonial times.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. You can send email to think@kera.org. That's where we hear from Keith. Keith writes, I've been out of high school for many years, and he wants to know whether any of the insights in American Tempest have found their way into the textbooks or how they might be accepted.
Well, the history is all there, the history of the original Tea Party movement, the history of the Civil War, which, again, grew out of, partially at least, out of the violation of federal government in terms of intruding in the rights to own property. Now, the tragic aspect of the Civil War is that the property involved were human beings. Mm-hmm. But nonetheless, they were property at that time. And the real problem of the rights of the individual versus the rights of the state, the collective rights of the state, were not resolved by the Civil War. And are under debate today. We debate whether which services are essential to the people and must be provided by the government. Is postal service an essential service that only government can offer? Is public transport a service that only government can offer? What should government be doing? What should federal government be doing, state government, and local government be doing? And what things should be done, should be left to the people to do for themselves? This is a debate that has been underway in this country from colonial times and is still under debate today. Should lawmakers in Congress be sitting there and devising a law, writing the law, passing a law that we all have to have a tag on our mattresses? These are things that, I think today's Tea Party movement, like the one in colonial times, are debating.
Do you think, Harlow, that it's healthy for us that we are still debating this 235 years later, or would we be better off somehow as a society if we all agreed on exactly what government's role ought to be?
Well, if we all agreed on what government was for, we'd be no better than Nazi Germany. We'd be all walking in goose steps behind a national leader. No, I think debate is very, very healthy. The Founding Fathers certainly believed in healthy debate. James Madison argued that the very vagueness of the Constitution is good because it will spawn debate and will be a living document that will continue to be changed. Unfortunately, in today's America, even last year's controversy-laden election, only 40% of Americans, of eligible voters, voted. And so, therefore, we now have a Congress that is acting much as Parliament did, without the consent of the people. If 40% voted, that means 20.1 theoretically, 20.1% of the electorate controlled the makeup of Congress. So that's no longer a free republic. That's almost a dictatorship by a tiny minority. And that is not healthy, and that is not what we should be doing. I think people should be debating the Constitution and the role of government, but all the people, or at least a large majority of the people, should be involved in the debate, and they're not. They are just ceding power to tiny minorities. And unfortunately, those minorities are usually in the control of shadow governments, of what some people like to call special interests, but really are either large corporations or large professional groups who dictate what is now going on in Congress.
Today's Tea Party obviously is not using or planning to use violence to achieve its ends, but I'm curious as to whether you think that it is an entity that has some real staying power, that is more than something of this decade.
Not right now, because it's not truly organized as a Tea Party movement. A lot of people are joining, a lot of disgruntled people, and people who are unhappy, legitimately unhappy, with the role of federal government in our lives, are joining this and using it as an umbrella. But there's no cohesiveness in it, largely because many of the people who are opposed to taxes, their opposition is rather selective. If you asked a farmer, for example, to define a boondoggle, he would not include agricultural subsidies as a boondoggle. He'd say, the subsidies for oil, that's a boondoggle. If you ask an oil man to define a boondoggle, he would not define government subsidies to the oil industry as a boondoggle. He'd describe subsidies to some other industry as a boondoggle. So this is the problem. There's no many of the organizations and people who have joined the Tea Party are against subsidies, government subsidies, and for everybody but themselves. And that is going to keep the Tea Party movement, today's Tea Party movement, from ever obtaining any real power.
The new book by journalist and historian Harlow Giles Unger is called American Tempest: How the Boston Tea Party Sparked a Revolution. Harlow, it's been a really interesting discussion. Thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Thank you for inviting me.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.